Welcome to International Tax Bites, a series of conversations around issues and concepts in international taxation. I'm Graham Jackson, and I'm a Gibraltar and English solicitor with Hassan's International Law Firm in Gibraltar. Today, I will be speaking to my podcast partner, Harriet Brown, who is a Jersey advocate and English barrister with Old Square Tax Chambers in London. So, here we are today, Harriet. We're going to be talking about it's basically a spin-off episode from an episode we've done before where we talked about foreseeable relevance. And today we're in more practical terms about what to do if you receive an international information exchange request and the tests that apply to those and what authorities should be doing and what they shouldn't be doing to try and give a broader context of international information requests than we focused on a very narrow thing. But for anybody who's listening, where we say the words foreseeable relevance, please do go back and listen to that episode. It deserves more listens than it's got because it's a very important concept. And Harriet really thinks it's great. So,
do I?
Yeah. You said you were like, oh no, because we put it out in summer, didn't we? So you were convinced it didn't get enough listens.
Well, I do think it was a decent, I think it was a solid episode. I'm not saying it was, you know, look, give it, it's an important concept. I put it no higher than that.
Right, okay. And you did all the work, so it must be great. I just sat and nodded. Right, so let's talk, first of all, about what is an international tax information exchange request.
Okay, so an international tax information exchange request, which is quite a mouthful, so we'll probably just call it a request going forward.
Yep.
Is a request from one jurisdiction to another jurisdiction for information.
There are three ways, aren't there? Or three forms in which these exchange requests can be generated. There's double taxation agreements.
There is. Tax information exchange
agreements. Information exchange agreements. And the third one, which is the multilateral version.
The Multilateral Convention on Mutual Administration in Tax Matters.
Right, okay. And that is a European Council document, not a European Union document. So there are lots of signatories outside of the EU, but it creates an international framework for everybody to exchange with each other without needing the standalone documents that were tax information exchange agreements.
Yes, though quite frequently you do, where there is an OECD model type DTA, you do quite often see tax authorities just, or at least stating that they're going through the model agreement, through the DTA article 26-ish.
Yeah. So I think HMRC prefers the DTA route, right? All the ones I've ever seen have gone through the DTA route.
Yeah, I have anecdotally heard that they don't like tiers because they have to pay for the reproduction of the documents if it's done under a tier. I don't know if that's true.
Wow.
But I've been told that. Could be complete nonsense.
I thought maybe, and this might also be complete nonsense, I thought maybe it might be something to do with the fact that we're the same, the overseas territories are the same state for the purposes of some things.
Yes, it could be. We'd have to dig through the signatories and how they signed up and what.
Yeah, I know the mutual convention is extended to Gibraltar, we're not a signatory of.
Right, okay, well, that would probably make sense.
Yeah, I went to court once. Have I told you I went to the Court of European Justice, Court of Justice of the European Union?
I don't think you've ever mentioned that, Graham.
So the country on the other side were trying to say that GIB was not a compliant jurisdiction and made the argument that we were not signatories to the convention, despite us not having the power to be signatories to the convention. Which was interesting, an interesting approach. Right, anyway, so there are these three routes, but they're all pretty much the same set of rules, are they? Overarching principles?
Yes, I mean, they all sort of follow the same principles, very much like tiers and the DTA, the concept of foreseeable relevance applies to the convention. So it's always going to be a fairly similar process. There might be small differences, so it's important to first make sure you know which route the requesting jurisdiction is using, and just to check that they have complied with the correct procedural necessities under that route.
Right. Okay. So what's the obligation on the issuing jurisdiction? What do they have to do apart from, I don't know, put the taxpayer's name on the top? Can they ask anything? Do
No,
these
they can't ask for absolutely anything.
and these things don't spring fully formed out of the ground, right? That you, I would imagine there's just practically got to be some sort of investigation going on.
Yes. So they can't sort of suddenly decide that they want that they want information and they quite like something different to have a look at. And so there's a process that has to be followed. And so if we look at, say, the process for tiers under the model, the OECD model, there has to be a request. And the request has to be it has to comply with certain requirements. So what the requesting, so the technically the requesting party could ask for any number of things, but what they need to show is the identity of the person under examination or investigation, and we're going to come back to what that means more generally in a minute. A statement of the information sought, including its nature and the form in which the applicant party wishes to receive the information, the tax purposes for which the information is sought, the grounds for believing that the information requested is held by the requested party or by somebody within the jurisdiction of the requested party, to the extent known, the name and address of any person believed to be in possession of the requested information. A statement that the request is in conformity with the law and administrative practices of the applicant party. A statement that the applicant party has pursued all means available in its own territory to obtain the information, except those that would be disproportionate. And so those are sort of the requirements, along with this concept of foreseeable relevance, that they are required to
Okay.
have. Yeah.
So
So
let's take them one by one.
okay.
Then let's go back to the identity of the taxpayer. So I'm guessing from the fact that you said that there's no necessary requirement for somebody's name.
No, they can be identified by reference to a group or a set of circumstances. So a common one would be all people who have entered into a particular avoidance arrangement that maybe has a DOTAS number, for example. That's something HMRC might use as an identifier.
Don't you swear at me mentioning DOTAS.
Sorry. We're not fans of DOTAS.
Anybody who doesn't know what DOTAS is, DOTAS is the most complicated thing on the history of the planet. It makes the Indian railways look like a positively simple system, right? So, the could it be something like all the people who are who you deal with who are tax resident in Belgium?
Well, that's a really interesting question, isn't it? because assuming that this would be a request coming from the Belgian authority.
Let's say.
Yeah. We have to ask ourselves, is that going to be a fishing expedition? And so that's a really interesting question, and where the line on a fishing expedition and sort of thoroughly bottoming out an investigation falls is a difficult one to say. But I think the requested authority or anybody being asked for information under that request could reasonably perhaps go back and say, well, look, that's a very broad category. And yes, while there is foreseeable relevance, because we can obviously see that any Belgian resident may well have Belgian tax issues. However, we don't feel like perhaps we don't feel like this is really targeted at people in relation to whom you have specific information. This is a bit broad. So
So it's
not
not enough
necessarily.
resolution, right? It's not granular enough. It's just too broad.
Arguably, I'm not sure. I'm not, there may be case law on this. I don't think there is, but I don't know the case law from all the jurisdictions. So it's possible, and the courts have. So it's a broad test anyway, and the courts have given quite a wide margin to tax authorities as well. So there's certainly, I think, a reasonable position that that's too broad, but I would need to see what a tax authority can get back with.
It would depend on the facts as they are of the person who it's targeted at, right?
Exactly, yes.
Yeah, so if somebody only sold really aggressive Belgian tax avoidance schemes to Belgians...
That might well, yes.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So that's... just about cover the identity. We know it needs to be narrow enough to identify a group or an individual, and it shouldn't be cast too widely to go beyond the investigation at hand, right?
Exactly, yes. Yeah.
Right, okay. So what was the information sought was the second thing that you read out. What was the third thing?
The tax purpose for which the information is sought, and that can be quite broad. So it can be, so we're investigating income tax or inheritance tax, or
so it doesn't need to be, you know, breaches of the transfer of asset abroad regime.
No,
just
no,
income tax liability.
Yes, I think what this is aimed at. So where you get a request not under a tier, because remember this is just a tier. Mm. So, but say you had a DTA request, it can be quite difficult for the requested party to know whether or not the request is a good one, if that makes sense. So, for example, if you don't know what the tax purpose of the request is, it's very hard to say whether or not it's foreseeably relevant, for example, because yeah. You just don't know.
Yeah,
because you don't know what you don't have enough information. So possibly this is aimed at avoiding that sort of issue arising.
Right. Okay. So, and then you said a fourth thing. The fourth thing was that the grounds for believing that the...
Why they think that either the authority or a person within the authority has possession or control of the information sought.
Right, okay. And then name and address of the person they're seeking the information of, obviously. But that's important, isn't it? That's important because if they write... If they don't get that person right, because the person that they're asking the information of must have the information in their possession and control, right?
Yes.
They should ask the right person. You can only reveal the information that's in your possession and control.
Yes.
So if they write to the wrong person who doesn't have the stuff in the possession or control, but that person knows who would have...
Yes.
No obligation on that person to go and get it for them. They should just write to the right person.
Yes, provided it's not within their control, i.e. provided that, say, a principal who didn't have the information but whose agent had it and held it on their behalf, obviously yeah. That would be in their control. So they would then have to go and say, agent, give me the information. But no, if they just happen to know that, say, maybe it's a trust and company service provider, TCSP, and they don't have the information.
And they know that an accountant has it.
Precisely. There is no obligation on them to say, oh, we haven't got this, but Mr. Smith has.
Right, okay. So they should just respond with, that's not in our possession of control.
Yes.
In fact, if they do go further and say, oh, Mr. Smith's got it, have they in somehow breached GDPR?
Yes, that's entirely possible. I mean, one would have to look at the specific circumstances, but yes, over provision of information risks coming into conflict with domestic law provisions like GDPR.
This is something that we talk about all the time, isn't it? And for those people who aren't in Europe and don't know what European initials stand for, it stands for General Data Protection
Regulations or regime, one or the other.
Regulation, general data.
I think it's regulations.
But it's the you can't process people's data without legal reason to do so or permission or whatever.
Yeah.
So you would be a person that's received this request would be in danger of breaching the privacy rights of the person the request is about if they go further in an attempt to cooperate. And that is the stick that sits at the other side of the stick that the tax authorities have got. So they've got, people have got to walk a narrow path between those two things.
Yes, I think that that's a very accurate statement. And with many things, what you see is a conflict, and often it is the person with the obligation who's put in the difficult position of having to make a judgment call on where the line falls between the two.
Yeah, and this is something that we talk about all the time. I mean, this is because we talk about information exchange and automatic and CRS and FATCA and all that. People in a position with information that's being requested or is demanded off them by the authorities, in the case of FATCA and CRS, it's not, you should never report just to be sure. You should be sure, if you know what I mean, right? It's not, don't do it just in case.
You certainly need to think about it and think about what you're doing, because you can't just go, oh, they've asked for it, therefore it must be okay for me to provide the information.
Yeah.
That's not necessarily the case. That's definitely an accurate statement of the position a requestee should take.
Tax authorities are made up of fallible human beings. And tax authorities can get things wrong, and they can ask for things that go further, or they can interpret the law in their favour when actually the correct position is somewhere between don't give them anything and give them everything. And those lines need to be protected, because people's rights are important.
Because you might get in trouble if you contravene those rights.
Well, there's that, but also on a moral basis.
Oh God, not this.
No, you
again.
Don't like it when I talk about morality, but you shouldn't. As a fiduciary, if you're a fiduciary, right, then you have fiduciary obligations.
Okay, I can get on board with fiduciary obligations, but they're not the same as moral obligations.
They're very close, though.
No. This is an argument for another day. I don't think we've had this argument yet, but we definitely should, but not now.
A fiduciary puts themselves in a moral obligation that is reinforced by law. That obligation, if I put you first, that's a moral obligation all day long.
That's a fiduciary obligation.
Which comes from the morality. But, you know, let's move on.
Let's have this argument another time. Yeah. So the next, there's a couple of other important points that I'd like to highlight, if I may. The requesting jurisdiction has to include a statement that the request is in conformity with the law and the administrative and its administrative practices, and that if the requested information was within the requesting jurisdiction, then it would be able to obtain the information under its own laws or in the normal course of administrative practice.
All right.
So that sounds slightly complicated. What that means is, if you have if you, revenue authority in jurisdiction A, have quite limited information powers, and this was a problem for some of the Crown dependencies because they didn't have extensive information powers because they didn't really need them. If you don't have the power to get it yourself, you can't circumvent your own law by saying, oh, but they've got really broad powers, so we'll just ask them to get it for us. Yeah. You're only entitled to what you could get in your own country if it were there, essentially.
That makes perfect sense.
Yes, and I think that's...
Why should I do something for you that you won't do for yourself?
Or that's quite a common theme, I think, that you see in international agreements. So, for example, treaties about criminal matters, only apply where the thing is a crime in both states, effectively.
Yeah.
And this is a similar sort of process.
But that's outside our remit. So let's
It is outside our remit, yes.
Gamble down that avenue too far.
Well, there is some tax advice that occasionally needs to be given in that respect. So, but yes, let's not go that way. So that is quite interesting. And that is that's one of the requirements of a tier that can be quite difficult for somebody getting a request, because you TCSP sitting in Gibraltar or Jersey or BVI aren't necessarily going to know what is the law and administrative practices, and particularly administrative practices of the UK or France or Germany or Luxembourg or wherever it is that's asking.
So even if, and God forbid that a tax authority would ever do this, even if the tax authority in insert name of jurisdiction just lied and said, yeah,
I just got it wrong. Just got it wrong.
Or got it wrong. Factual error. They thought something had been done and it hadn't been done, right? The person who signed the letter off.
That's, yeah.
You, not for you to, it's not for you as the recipient of the request, the individual,
to assume it's been done correctly.
To assume it's been done correctly. But can the intermediary tax authority, so the recipient authority, do they have some sort of doctrine? Some sort of doctrine says they can rely on what other tax authorities tell them in this.
Yeah, so the purpose of that statement, so if you recall, what the requirement for the requesting party is that they include a statement that this is in conformity with their laws and administrative practices and that they could get the information if the information were within their jurisdiction. That is there exactly so that the requested jurisdiction can rely on it. And they can, so just less relevant because we don't ever see them, but important to remember, the information request is made from country to country, from tax authority to tax authority. And if the tax authority that's being asked for something already has it, it will just flick it on. It won't tell you. It will just hand it over. So in those circumstances, that tax authority would, I think, rely on that statement. And they'd go, oh, well, we've got a statement of his income in this jurisdiction for 2009, 2010, whatever it is. Here you go.
Just a thought, and I don't want to give Brussels any ideas, but how long till the European Union allows those requests to go direct from Germany to person in France instead of going through the French authorities?
I don't know.
It feels like that's something that they would do to harmonise, wouldn't it? If they would harmonise the information powers, and then they would just allow you to go direct.
There's a huge sovereignty issue there, isn't there? And I think you see that's actually highlighted about a lot of the, and this is an ever so slight tangent, Graham, but only a very slight tangent. The case law in England around actually domestic information powers, and in the UK, well, in England and Wales, domestic information powers have been held to be so broad that HMRC made a valid information request under those domestic powers to a person resident in Dubai.
Oh, wow.
There was said to be no territorial limitations on them. It was an interesting decision. It's a really interesting decision. So, but there are all sorts of issues around sovereignty. And I think asking for information is one thing.
So in that case, it would be valid, but they wouldn't be able to enforce, right? Would they, against the guy in Dubai? Isn't that banning smoking in Paris? Like that?
No, and that's why it's a very interesting case, because it's sort of, it draws a distinction. I think, I should have looked at this before we started, but I didn't quite know we were going to get here. It may, whether or not any penalties for failure to comply are valid, may well turn on that.
Yeah.
But anyway, so, that's an episode for another day, because
that is really interesting. It takes us nicely to the all domestic means are exhausted element of the request that you highlighted.
It doesn't. That is, of course, not what it says.
So what does it say? Enlighten me.
Well, that's perhaps what it should say. It says that the requesting party has to include a statement that says it has pursued all means available in its own territory to obtain the information. And this is the important bit, except those that would give rise to disproportionate difficulties.
Oh, right. So we've exhausted everything that's easy.
Well, I don't know. I'm not aware of any case law on the meaning of disproportionate difficulty in this case. But again, it's an interesting question, isn't it? What is proportionate here?
Yeah. So we don't know. So let's just move on.
I don't know. No.
And I don't even know who is the disproportionate difficulty aimed at, the tax authorities or at
If I'm HMRC and I want some information and it's too difficult to get in England and Wales or the UK, I write to the commissioner in Gibraltar, say, can you get this information? It was too difficult for me to get it here.
Right, okay. So if it's some, I don't know, I'm a massive internet giant that keeps everything on index cards instead of on a computer, and you write to me and say, get me Harriet Brown's details, and I say, oh, it's going to take me months.
You're the internet giant. No, it's not the difficulty for you. It's the difficulty for the tax authority. So,
if there's a difficulty for me, then there is a difficulty for the tax authorities, because they can't get it from me, because I can say, that's disproportionate, I can't give it to you.
That comes in at a later stage. Here we're looking at the difficulty for the tax authority. So it may be that there is a mechanism by which they can obtain information. So, for example, they might be able to get the same information by pulling an accountant up in front of a judge and having him examined, say. But that might be disproportionately difficult to get something that's written down on a piece of paper in Gibraltar. I don't know. I'm not saying it is, but it's that sort of, you know, if there's a complex or time-consuming process, certain in the UK, again, in the UK, certain exercise of certain information powers requires sign-off from a tribunal.
Right.
Okay. And that might be considered disproportionately difficult.
I understand.
It might not.
So we've worked through the elements of the request, right, which goes from
yes, I was just double checking
which goes from originating jurisdiction to target jurisdiction.
Yeah,
then the target jurisdiction, the tax authorities in the target jurisdiction, they have an obligation, do they just scan through it? Yeah, that looks right, stamp, pass it on.
My view is that they shouldn't do that. I think they can rely on the so where we've got a tier request, they can rely on the statements that the requesting jurisdiction is required to make.
Those statements of compliance that we talked about.
Yeah, that's it exactly. So yeah, it's too difficult, or we can't do it, or it's just not here. And we could get it if we're in all of that. I don't think they have to go and dig out the background law in the jurisdiction that's making the request. However, if something isn't foreseeably relevant, they absolutely shouldn't flick that request on to a third party in their jurisdiction, a taxpayer or a third party in their jurisdiction, if on a reading of it, you know, I mean, they're not required to dig and investigate, but if on a reading of it, it's clearly not foreseeably relevant. So take the example of, I want residential addresses for all people who have used this company in the last 50 years who have red hair or are related to somebody with red hair.
Yeah.
We've got a few problems there. 50 years is too long for a variety of reasons. but also, red hair has no relevance to taxability.
Would you say it's a reasonableness test? Do they look at it and say, is this reasonable? Or do they have to do a bit more than that?
So I think, look at it this way. Say I am the tax authority in Jersey, and I receive an information request from the French Revenue Authority. I look at it, and one of the things I'm going to consider is whether or not I already have the information that the French Revenue Authority want, or if I'm going to need to pass the request on. Now, in those circumstances, I, as Revenue Jersey, sit there and I look at the request. If the information isn't foreseeably relevant, even if I have it already, I shouldn't just pass it on to the French authority. Mm. So my view is that that same sort of assessment should be made before the information is requested, if they don't have the information they need to ask for it.
Right. Okay. So yeah, they should. So they should be doing an analysis of some sort.
Yeah. It's about good administration, isn't it? Really.
They're not a postbox.
Exactly. They're not a postbox. They're not a rubber stamp.
And they're being asked to exercise domestic powers, so they should exercise those domestic powers
properly and with as a reasonable tax authority would, which includes thinking about whether or not they're required to be exercised.
So what happens if? What happens if they're domestic? So they can't exceed their domestic powers.
No,
because if they've got a request that is foreseeably relevant, meets all the criteria, but it asks them to go and get information that they're not permitted to under the domestic rule,
they won't be able to
say we can't do it. Right? Okay.
Yes. Though generally that is now unlikely to happen, because in terms of getting these network of tiers and in terms of signing up to the mutual convention.
They have to get everything to align.
Yeah, there was a requirement to have certain minimum domestic powers. So, for example, this is why Jersey was much slower to get tiers than Guernsey, because Jersey had to change its domestic information powers more significantly than Guernsey did.
Right. Okay. So I think, but I mean, foreseeable relevance, I'm guessing, is embedded in people's domestic powers as well.
So,
In some jurisdictions, at least.
look, it depends how things are pulled in. So, and it depends what domestic powers you are using. I would say, as a general rule, a revenue authority shouldn't have the power to obtain information that it doesn't need. That's not in anybody's interests. It's not, it probably infringes certain rights, probably infringes Article 8 of the European Convention on Human Rights, which is right to private and family life, the family life being less relevant here, for them to go around and exercise a power to get information they simply don't need. So there's that aspect to it. But really, it's going to depend on the domestic law. But yes, I mean, I can't see any statutory or similar body having authority to get information just because it feels like it.
Yeah. Okay.
That sort of feels wrong, doesn't
Yeah,
it?
that definitely does. Though we're very lucky to live in countries that follow the ECHR. So, and that was not a comment on any Conservative Party policy in the UK. Okay, so when people receive, so it's we've gone through the process, the originated jurisdiction has issued the document. The target jurisdiction has looked at it and gone, yeah, that looks about right. I see the foreseeable relevance there, and they've made all those declarations of compliance that are required. And then they send out the information request to a bank. What does the recipient, what's the approach that they need to take? Are they allowed to review it?
Not only are they allowed to, but my view is that they have a duty to, which probably comes within a sort of fiduciary duty type of situation. So what I
Or
this
maybe.
no, it's absolutely not a moral obligation.
Think it might be. Go on. Anyway, so they've got a duty to. It's, so they've got a, probably they've got a duty under GDPR, which we established before. They've probably got a fiduciary duty if they are a bank, which I know all the bankers are jumping up and down shouting, banks are not fiduciaries. But as we know, banks can be fiduciaries in certain circumstances.
Yeah, I mean, being a fiduciary doesn't just mean being a trustee. I think a lot of people think of fiduciary and trustee as synonymous. And of course, fiduciary encompasses a much wider range of.
Being in a position of trust rather than a trustee.
So, for example, directors have certain fiduciary duties. They're just different to the ones that a trustee has.
Yeah. It's a really good, there's a really interesting article which covers whether banks are fiduciaries in the
Is
policy
there?
of taxation. Yeah. Graham Jackson wrote a cracking piece of work. Anyway, okay, so banks can be fiduciaries, and we think that this is a fiduciary duty on them to not get this wrong. So they've got this obligation then
Statutory fiduciary, they've got a number of obligations.
to test this information request that's come to them from the authorities. And in what ways are they, so what ways are they principally allowed to test it, and what in principle allowed to test it, and in what ways are they practically able to test it?
So this is always going to be difficult. Generally speaking, when you get an information request, you have a relatively short time period in which to comply with it. If you're in the position, say, of the bank, a third party from whom domestic revenue authority is getting information for foreign revenue authority. So for example, and I'm sorry to give Gibraltar as an example again, but I happen to know that Gibraltar is 30 days. Jersey, I think, is usually 30 days as well. So there is a limited period. And so if we just go back to, say, for example, what we're looking at under a tier, so there are very basic requirements, such as very basic sort of positions. Does it identify people under examination or investigation? Can you identify the information? So very basic things. Does it tell you what the tax purpose is for which the information is sought? And does it particularize that sufficiently? And that might be very limited particularization depending on the circumstances, but does it particularize that sufficiently that you can judge foreseeable relevance on the basis of it? So, for example, we gave the example of, please give us details of all, I think we said Belgian residents, didn't we? And
Yeah.
we can see that Belgian residence is likely to be relevant, for example, to income tax. That's not a particularly big leap to make. Belgian income tax, anyway. not just income tax everywhere. So that's that. So we're really looking, do we have enough information to see whether or not this is foreseeably relevant? Is it foreseeably relevant? And if we don't have enough information to understand whether or not it's foreseeably relevant, we might want to go back and say, sorry, but we can't, this just doesn't give us enough to say whether or not the information you're asking is within this purview of foreseeable relevance. Or alternatively,
so you're in a position, what you're saying there, what you seem to be implying there, you're in a position to say, look, I'm just not going to do this because it's not foreseeably relevant.
That was my second string. My first string is I'm unable to tell whether or not it's foreseeably relevant.
Okay.
My second string is it's not
foreseeable. I can tell and it isn't. Yeah.
I can tell and it isn't. So I'm not going to be giving you the information because I'm only... So we've got this tension between domestic provisions like GDPR and the international treaty here. And so if you are giving somebody the... If you're giving a tax authority the information and it's not foreseeably relevant, you shouldn't be supplying it because they have no right to get it. And therefore, this intersection of the two concepts or this intersection of the two sets of legislation, you go straight past. And it's only the fact of it being properly required under these provisions that stops you breaching GDPR. So you're going to end up breaching GDPR because you've got no statutory excuse, i.e. the need for it under the treaty. So you need to be looking at this sort of stuff. And it's not unreasonable to say, don't think this is foreseeably relevant, or I have literally no idea what you're going on about. Please, can you explain why this is foreseeably relevant?
Now, so let's just put a marker down as a note of caution here, because we're talking from our perspective, from our standpoint, the legislative regimes that we understand. I have literally no idea if there is a similar regime in Thailand or Namibia as there is to GDPR. So anybody listening, you need to obviously understand the framework that you work in rather than the framework that we work in. And we're telling you, it's not for us to tell you everything about
your jurisdiction. No, absolutely.
The kind of things that we would be thinking about in this situation.
But that's a great point, Graham, because one of the huge issues for somebody getting an information request is you need to understand, or you need to be able to get advice quickly on what the position is under the law of the other jurisdiction. And so
I see.
I'm a lawyer, say, sitting in Jersey. I am given a request by Revenue Jersey, or my client is given a request by Revenue Jersey, and Revenue Jersey has said, yeah, this is all great. We've had, you know, it's got all the statements in it. It's come from, let's take Thailand. I have no idea what the law and administrative practices of Thailand say about what information the Thai revenue authorities can get, and whether or not this is disproportionately difficult. So I can't test whether or not those statements are true. And if I want to challenge this, or the taxpayer whose information I'm handing on wants me to challenge this, assuming that I can tell them about it, which we'll come on to in a minute, then I need to be in a position where I am simply where I can get advice, because I don't know, and I can't just assume it's the same.
I think we're actually taking a slightly stronger position than the one that you said, because there you just said, if I want to challenge it. I think we established, didn't we, that for a lot of the people that will be receiving these requests, there's a duty to challenge it if there's a problem.
There's a duty to understand it before you comply with it. Yes, I think that's absolutely right.
But if it in itself is non-compliant when you understand it,
you shouldn't.
You're obliged to challenge it.
I think you're obliged not to provide the information. And if you're not going to provide the information to protect yourself, you've got to say why.
Yeah. So roundabout way, you end up with the same result. You've got to stick your head up and say, I'm not doing this because X and Y. If you don't equip yourself with the information to allow you to do that, then you've failed in your duty to your client, customer, person whose information you hold.
Potentially, yes.
That's a barrister's answer. Like, it was an absolute slam dunk. I got you there. I took you step by step and went, there you go. And you went, potentially. My old philosophy lecturer would have been very pleased with that that argumentation that went on there. But you
think that's why he's a philosophy lecturer and not
let
a
me have,
barrister.
Would you? Yeah. He can draw a truth table, which is more than barristers do. There's loads of logical fallacies in barristers' argumentation.
Obviously.
Yeah. Anyway.
Logical fallacy is a human trait, I think.
So we'll move on.
Probably wise.
We'll move on. So you do not need to respond completely. You may have a duty to object, potentially. And you've got competing duties to comply and not to comply. Now, there's a question of privilege as well, isn't there?
So there is a number of exceptions when you won't be required to provide information. One of those that arises most commonly is if it is legally privileged information. Again, this is a concept in most common law jurisdictions. But this is in most jurisdictions sort of have a similar concept, but essentially communications between lawyers and their clients are privileged. So that's legal advice privilege. And then you have also got litigation privilege, which sort of goes to litigation documents, etc. So that is, that is sort of where we are, really. That's the most common one.
Some jurisdictions have extended that to cover TCSPs and accountants. Again, it's even with privilege, it's jurisdiction specific, right? So you need to be fully aware of the situation that you are working in.
Exactly.
Okay, so we've got to the point where the recipient of the request has tested. And then what, they just provide the information? Can they redact things? Can they, again, obviously applying the foreseeable relevance test, can they redact information from documents that identify other parties that aren't relevant? Can they?
So obviously you've got a variety of possible requests. So you might have sort of a group request in inverted commas where it identifies people by characteristics. So all residents of the UK, something like that. In those circumstances, it's probably it's more difficult. Though, of course, if it was something as broad as residents of the UK, if you had somebody who was a resident of Namibia, then you could redact them because it's clearly not relevant. But say you get a request for information about Mr. Jones.
Yeah.
And you are providing documents that mentions both Mr. Jones and Mrs. Smith. You can redact any information that is Mrs. Smith specific. You can redact her name. That must be right.
Okay. Given A, this is not advice, and B, the facts of each individual case.
It's going to be a judgment call on the facts. And sometimes it'll be very clear, actually, that you've got a document and you need to take something out.
Yeah.
Because they're not entitled to that.
Yeah.
And in other cases, there might be more of a grey area. What I would say is, if you do redact a document, in your cover letter, explain why you've redacted it. This is a different taxpayer who's not within the terms of the request. We've taken out their details.
Yeah. So exactly. We're mentioning this just to show that it can be possible, not that you should get your Sharpie out and start
down on it. Yeah.
Preparing the facts for the tax authorities to see this evening. So then we can just comply with the time limit. We file with the tax and with our home tax authorities.
Yeah.
Then what do? They just pass it straight on? So just go back as is? Or do they then review what we've sent again? Or does it matter? Does it depend?
I think it's going to depend. And that's also, I mean, the information is confidential. It has to be kept confidential. There's a whole article in the model tier about confidentiality.
So can your home tax authorities use it for their own purposes, or is it just goes off?
I think if they wanted to, I think they probably could, because they've had to get it using their information powers, haven't they? The treaty doesn't confer some magic international treaty power. So they've got it because they had the power to get it. So presumably there shouldn't be a problem with them using it.
So important to note then, if a third country then sends an information request about that taxpayer and that information is relevant, they can send that without referring back to the recipient of the original letter.
Yes, if the tax authority already has the information, and I would say because it's been requested by jurisdiction A under request A, that doesn't make any difference as to them having it and being able to provide it to jurisdiction B under request B subsequently.
Yeah, so UK asks Jersey for some information about a Jersey resident. Then France asks for the same information about the same person. They don't need to, it doesn't need to be another process. It can just be.
No, they have the information. And if it's foreseeably relevant and the request meets all of the administrative, et cetera, requirements, they can then send it on to France. Now, it'd be interesting what information is foreseeably relevant. Well, actually, it wouldn't be. That's why I have double tax agreements, isn't it? Probably there's quite a lot that's foreseeably relevant to taxes in more than one jurisdiction.
Company details and accounts and blah, blah, blah.
Yeah.
There'll be loads that could be covered by more than one country.
Yeah.
If a company owns assets in two countries, there you go.
Exactly.
Okay. So I think then that we've gone through the whole process from top to finish, top to bottom, even.
Yes. The only thing that we haven't done, which we're not going to do in any detail because this is very much a matter for domestic law, but obviously there's also the possibility that you get a request, you go back to your, so jurisdiction A asks jurisdiction B asks TCSP in jurisdiction B. TCSP looks at the request and says, not foreseeably relevant or not compliant with the procedural requirements, whatever it is, sends it back and says, no, we're not complying with this. Jurisdiction B disagrees. Jurisdiction B says, fork over that information, smartish, or else we're going to penalise you under our domestic law, whatever that penalty is. You may well have a specific appeal process. That's present in a lot of jurisdictions, like, for example, Jersey, where there is a specific appeal process for these. You may be able to challenge it under judicial review. So you would be challenging the decision of the local tax authority to put the request forward to you, effectively.
Right, okay. So the ultimate recourse in a common law jurisdiction is a judicial review.
Yes, and there may well be other rights of appeal or review in non-common law jurisdictions, but again, that's not something I can comment on. But it's highly unlikely that the revenue authority sending you it and you saying, not sure about this, and them going, well, we are fork over, is going to be the final step if you really want to push back.
Yeah.
Or if you feel that you have to push back.
So if they issued the penalty, I mean, I'm just trying to think this through. If they issued the penalty and you refused to pay it, they'd have to take you to court to enforce it, right? You'd get a chance then, would you?
No. So what... Well, look, the way I think it would work in England and Wales is this. They give you a penalty. You don't pay the penalty. You can at that stage, you can appeal the penalty. That's what you should do.
Right. But if they were enforcing the penalty against you, then it would be, was the request valid rather than...
I'm not sure that it would. So you don't pay the penalty. The time to appeal the penalty expires. They then start enforcement proceedings in the civil courts. The civil courts, certainly in England and Wales, are going to say, well, you had the opportunity to appeal this and you didn't. It's a good debt.
They're thinking about a different question. Is it a valid debt? Not rather than...
Yes, exactly.
I'm told before. That's what I was trying to say, but I didn't get there. Okay. So, well, that's that then. We've done it. Everything's finished and people are complying and tax authorities are being tested correctly as to compliance and foreseeable relevance.
Information is usually being provided because most of the time tax authorities will be getting it right. And everybody is happy and more tax compliant than they were before, which is all anybody ever wanted.
All as a result of this episode. And I'm very, very happy that we've basically fixed the international tax system.
We do that at least once an episode, Graham, and yet here we are, and they still seem to think we need BEPS. And now apparently an individual BEPS as well. So
yeah. So well, thank you very much for that. And this is obviously not advice, though it has been quite advicey. Please do not rely on what we've said. Each jurisdiction is different, though they all work within international frameworks, as we've been discussing.
And each case is different. Each request is different.
Yeah. So really, when you get an information request, if you're in England and Wales, please immediately reach out to Harriet. If you get an information request, then you must take fully competent advice in all the relevant jurisdictions. This is a very specialised area. Do not take it to your high street advisor. You need to go and find a specialist in these areas. There are lots of them around. A chartered tax advisor would be good. So this is just a conversation between two people talking about tax. And thank you very much for listening.
Thank you.